This is the Partnership Playbook, a podcast helping sales and marketing leaders secure high-value partnerships that finally unlock business growth and reclaim time. I'm your coach, Phil Hayes-Sinclair. Welcome to the show.
Everyone, welcome. We are in for a treat today. Niven Posma is who I'm interviewing, and this person is, I think, probably best described as a humanitarian, an author that makes people pay notice, and a senior leader who has been involved in financial services for a very long time. There is such magic to talk about today in all the things that Niven sees. And so, Niven, thank you for spending the time with us, because I think we are going to share a lot with people that they're going to love.
Oh, Phil, thank you for that lovely introduction. I've never heard myself introduced like that before, so I'm already delighted to be here.
Well, I would love to start with your backstory, because what I think people, if they were to look at your profiles online, they would find that you've written a very poignant book, particularly for these times. I suspect it will be a book that will persevere for many generations to come in relevance. We have you involved in some extraordinary humanitarian efforts in South Africa and the broader world. And then from a leadership point of view, there is this extraordinary bank of senior, difficult roles that I'm sure you look back on and think, how did that all happen over such a long career? Let's start with the backstory. How did we get here with Niven?
Yeah, now that's an interesting question. I suppose it brings to mind that Kierkegaard quote, life has to be lived forwards, but can only be understood backwards. Mm-hmm. So, and people think it's a Steve Jobs quote. No, it's not. I think if I look at myself as a kid, someone who really had no idea what she wanted to be when she grew up, and when adults asked her that question, just gave them a slightly confused look. I think what I understand now about myself then is that I never knew what I wanted to do, but I always knew the kind of person I wanted to be and the kind of life I wanted to live. So a job, a profession on an organogram, no clue. But what I knew I didn't want to do was this seemingly inevitable. You go to school, you go to university, you work, you take a few holidays in between things and hope for the best, then you retire, and then you die. What? No, that sounds like a nightmare. No, I'm sure things are much more interesting than that. And so, I kind of made up my own script, and I backpacked for 4 years after high school, having finished high school at 17. Only started studying when I was 21, have taken 2 sabbaticals, one to just read for a year because I was very close to burnout, another one to drive around South Africa for a year. I am also now in a position where I very much intersperse the rest of my life with my work life. And so this idea of putting it all on hold until some magical date on the calendar and some magical amount in the bank, I never understood it then. I don't understand it now. When colleagues talk about retiring, I'm like, but we're knowledge workers. What are we retiring from? Mm-hmm. Thinking, learning. But why would we want to retire from that? So I plan to work into my 80s, and somebody said to me the other day, just your 80s? My father's 95 and still goes to his law practice every day because he loves it so much. I'm like, okay, my 90s. I'm going to work into my 90s. In between doing other very interesting, meaningful, delightful things in life.
When you entered financial services, and we look at your history in the Reserve Bank, Standard Chartered, how did that come about for you? Was that for a traditional path where you studied and it felt like a logical step into that kind of industry? Or was there a catalyst for that to happen? Because it feels as though the exposure you had there then opened doors to many other things, which we can now talk about as well.
Yeah, so actually those experiences were midway in my career. So in fact, the things that had opened before that led to those. And then yes, for sure, those open things. But no, there was no logical transition. So in fact, my entry into the Reserve Bank was I had known the governor of the bank in a previous role. And she reached out to me and said she wanted people in the bank who could really help change the culture of the bank. And for that, you needed people who were not dyed-in-the-wool career central bankers. She wanted people who didn't know much about central banking, who had a different perspective, because this was after the wake of, well, in the wake of the global financial crisis, where central banks had a real existential crisis because banking and economies had a real existential crisis. So I said to her, well, Governor, if you're looking for somebody who knows nothing about central banking, I'm perfect because I know less than nothing. Yeah, I mean, I know the central bank exists, but that's about it. And so, yeah, I mean, like with all of the roles that I had after my first role, I mean, my first job is really the only job I looked for. After that, I'm the kind of person who, unlike many people, I look at a blank piece of paper and no job description because I'm the first person to do it. And if I were to have a job description, it would probably be figure it out. Okay, fine. I mean, I love that kind of stuff. Other people run away screaming. And so all of the roles that I've had after that first role as a strategy consultant were through networks, were through opportunities, and those two were the same. And it was the same as Standard Bank. Somebody that I knew there knew that they were looking for a head of leadership and culture. And she said, you know, I think, and this was a new role, same as all the roles that I had at the central bank, and said, you know, I think Niven could be good. And they started a whole bunch of conversations. And so, yeah, it wasn't financial services per se. It was, what is it that I want to do next? What are the kinds of opportunities that I want to have? What's the kind of impact that I want to have? What are the kind of people I want to work with? And then having been pretty clear on that in my own mind, then using that checklist that I had against the opportunities that came, and those opportunities happened to be in financial services, but that was the means. It wasn't the end, if that makes sense.
It does. And when we think about partnerships, and we talk about that a lot here, you know, from a business point of view, how companies and banks and institutions work with each other, it's often very surprising to me that people don't realize how central relationships are to getting business done. And that example where you mentioned that somebody you'd worked with previously reached out and said, would you think about coming across to do this, is often the greatest accelerant to any kind of relationship moving forward in life. And I'm always surprised when people look at these kind of partnerships and go, how did that happen so quickly? So people often know each other in a different context before. They've enjoyed working together again. They said, why wouldn't we do this another time? So I'm always fascinated about that.
Yeah, and I think also when it comes to relationships, I think a lot of people feel that, oh, I've got to spend all this time and energy and effort cultivating them and maintaining them. And I think there is some truth in that. You know, so I was giving a lecture earlier today and I was saying to people, look, we need to spend as much time focusing on our to-do list and actually getting through the tasks at hand. But how many times we focus on the to-do list at the expense of the to-build list? And when I'm talking about the to-build, I'm talking about the relationships that you can leverage and that will leverage what you are doing on your behalf, will be in the rooms for you, speaking for you when you're not there. Because frankly, some of the most important decisions of our career are made when we're not in the room. So who's in the room for us, you know? So yes, your to-do list matters, but your to-build list matters even more. So, you know, that's absolutely true in my experience. And it's been absolutely true in my career. And that said, these relationships can be dormant for a very long time. I mean, one of my anchor clients now for the last 6 or 7 years came originally from somebody who I had met once 15 years before. I'd invited him in for a debate at the business school. I mean, it was quite a memorable debate. I intended it to be. And I had completely lost touch with him. But, you know, the world is a small place. South Africa is a small place. So he knew of the work that I was doing. And then reached out after 15 years to say, look, there's this opportunity. I think you might be right. So, you know, I think it's a both end. Focus on the to build. Look at the relationships that you're making. But be prepared to be amazed at the seemingly dormant relationships that suddenly pop up with opportunities.
I love that. And there, I can think of a thousand opportunities that have arrived out of the blue when you look back and think, well, I think what actually happened 10 years ago, 5 years ago, whenever it was, we made them feel something that they ordinarily wouldn't feel. It created a memory. And then when opportunity meets memory, goodness tends to come, right? And it's, I find that the investment in those things, the magic seemingly that would come from that is so different to what people often relate to networking to be. and you know, go to LinkedIn and build a network and go to events and build networks. Yeah, I'm not sure that's the game. Like the game we're playing here is how do we connect ourselves with people that are fascinating in a way that we can add value to them, that at some point maybe they would like to do the same back. And I think if we enter into conversations like that, it becomes a very different way to live life.
Oh, 100%. Yeah, I mean, because I've got to go out and network on LinkedIn. Okay. You know, it feels so transactional and extractive and exhausting. No, the serendipity, the magic of people and connections and opportunities and relationships, I mean, that's delightful. Yeah. But seeing it as a task and a task that has to be done and a chore, well, I mean, you know, how much further down in my chair can I sink?
Yeah. Let's talk about politics and in those roles that you've mentioned before and in all the roles that we tend to face into, frankly, if there's other people involved, politics will be present. Mm-hmm. And I think many people sort of mistake politics to be an ugly, messy game that is a necessity whenever you're entering into large organizations, into government, into the public forum. You've written a book, and I'll see if I get this right. If you don't do politics, politics will do you. Mm-hmm. Tell me about the origin for that publication. We're going to link to this because there's something really interesting in the way that we can enter politics in any part of life, which becomes quite an advantage if you understand the game that's being played. So I'd love to understand more about how you frame politics and what it means and how people can be using that in their lives. If they're going to work right now, they're listening to this and thinking, oh, I've got a lot to face into in my large organization and things aren't looking great right now. Let's unpack that a little bit so people can work that through.
Yeah, so often when people hear the phrase workplace politics, you know, they think of a corporate, even though it's not just restricted to corporates, it happens in all organizations, like you said. They think of it almost like the workplace equivalent of that TV reality show Survivor, right? Which I don't watch, but my mother is a complete nut about. She really likes that program. And I know enough about it to know that the tagline is outwit, outplay, outlast. You know, so it's kind of the daily career equivalent of going leopard crawling and checking things out and just hanging in there to outwit, outplay, outlast. Well, yeah, I mean, look, it could be that, but personally, I can't think of a more exhausting / revolting way of spending 40 years of my life. So that's not what it is. I mean, it can be, but that's not necessarily what it is. The way I define and frame and think about politics is it's about all the informal, the unofficial, the behind the scenes things that happen in organizations, in all organizations, and frankly, not just in organizations, in our families as well. You know, it's how human beings show up in terms of the informal, the unofficial ways that we use our power, build our power, get influence, use influence, accrue influence, really to get things done. And I had this fabulous conversation last week where somebody said something and I thought, yes, that's exactly right. And what he said was, yes, politics are not a bug of organizations, they're a feature. Yes. You know, the way I've always described it is when somebody says to me that their organization is political or has politics, as though this is some big revelation. No, do me a favor. I mean, telling me that your organization has politics is like telling me that water is wet. Of course it's got politics. The question is not whether it's got politics, but what kind of politics it's got. And so this informal, unofficial, behind-the-scenes efforts, I mean, this is inevitable. And not understanding this is one of the key mistakes that people make, because there are really three stages of maturity when it comes to playing politics and having political will and skill. The first stage, absolutely, can be naivety and avoidance. So you see it as a bug. You see it as something to be eliminated. You see it as something that's a distraction that stands in the way of productivity and effectiveness. And that's one way of looking at it. A more mature way of looking at it, a more pragmatic way of looking at it is stage two, where it's coping and endurance. So you recognize the inevitability of it. You recognize the importance of it. You don't exactly relish it, but okay, you can grit your teeth and get on with it. And then stage three is when it is leveraging and proficiency. you recognize, look, this is just how things work. Mm. And so assuming that you're in a place where you want to learn the rules of how politics are played in that place in order to achieve what that place is setting out to achieve, well, then you start getting proficient and you leverage it. And what I repeatedly say is it's not just for you. It is for the people who are counting on you, be that your stakeholders, your team, your partners, because there is research that says, you know, the people who are working for politically engaged and politically effective managers are themselves more engaged at work. And so often, you know, this idea that politics is only negative, only unfair, only destructive and exclusionary, that is a kind of politics. That's a version of politics, sure. But this negative view of politics, often it comes from people who are not good at politics. Because when you're good at it and you are either consciously or unconsciously and consciously or unconsciously competent, well, then you just get on with it and you reap the benefits.
So somebody who has heard that explanation and feels an almost a visceral response to, but I just don't think I'm political. Like there's almost an identity that could be absorbed by that. I'm here to do great work. I'm here to lead my team. I'm here to, I'm very vision focused. I see the vision of my company and frankly, I'm going to put politics aside and I'm just going to get the job done.
How long do I have to start laughing and when can I stop? Well, no, I'm joking. I mean, you know, do I laugh or do I cry? Because I say both of those in complete recognition of how people are feeling. I mean, look, I was incredibly young when I got promoted to a very senior position. So I was a CEO at 29. And full frankly, I would not have hired me. So how this board hired me, I don't know. So I totally get what people are saying. I didn't really have to climb the ladder. I just got catapulted in. So I'm laughing and I'm crying, not in derision, but in complete recognition and agreement with that point of view, because that was the point of view I had for 20 years of my career.
Yeah,
I'm a very, I like to think that I take my value seriously. And in fact, I know that I take my value seriously because I sometimes get groups in leadership classes to think about, tell me about your values, but tell me about a time that you paid a price for your values. Because frankly, until you pay a price for them, they're corporate wallpaper. So I have paid a price for my values. They matter immensely to me. And I really thought that this was a mutually exclusive thing. I could either live my values and be true to them, or I could play politics. Because, of course, only people who sell their soul play politics. And actually, that was such a narrow-minded way of looking at this. And it was woefully naive to think that I'm just here to do my job. Mm. Yeah, sure. Your formal job description, your formal KPIs, the formal part of any organization, the organogram, the delegation of authority. I mean, these things, of course, they matter. And of course, they're real. And they're incredibly important. But just as real and just as important is the informal. Who knows who, who's looking out for who, how you need to socialize ideas, the meetings before the meetings, all of these things. Now, these are not written down anywhere. But particularly the more senior you get, you have to understand that these things are not a distraction from your job. They are your job. You're having to navigate these things to be effective. And you can choose not to. I mean, this is your career. This is your choice. Make the choices that you want. But for heaven's sake, make them be informed choices. And if you choose to ignore the political, well, good luck, because as I saw on a billboard in Lagos years ago, you're not in the traffic. You are the traffic. This is happening around you, whether you like it or not. When it comes to the opportunity cost of not being effective politically and not accruing power that can be used for good, the opportunity cost is huge. And like Jeffrey Pfeffer at Stanford Graduate School of Business says, you know, if we want more power to be used for good in organizations, in the world, well, we need more good people to have power. And the third thing is, don't make the mistake of thinking that just because you're technically correct, that you're being effective. Correct and effective are not the same thing. They're not necessarily mutually exclusive, but they are not the same thing. And making all of these mistakes means that you are setting yourself up at a severe disadvantage. It's essentially like you're playing tennis on half the court, you know, rugby on half the field, cricket on half the pitch, because all organizations are a combination of the formal and the informal. and to focus just on what's said, take things just at face value, and just what's in your job description, instead of understanding that the politics fit in the white spaces between the words in your job description, and it's just as important. Again, like I say, it's entirely your choice. Ignore everything I'm saying. But there's a risk in that, and there's an opportunity cost in that.
Is politics different in different centers of the world? So when we think about the epicenters of commerce, in the New Yorks, in the Londons, in Sydney, in Asia, Singapore, how is politics different between those centers? Because I think at a core human level, what you've just described is probably happening in some form everywhere.
Yeah.
But how in your experience does culture affect that? Because, you know, I would imagine that, you know, people, we often have this in Australia going into, in inverted commas, Asia, there are many people for a long time who considered, completely incorrectly, of course, that Asia is one amorphous continent, right?
Yeah,
we don't have any distinction. When you go across the border from Singapore to Malaysia, fine. I mean, it's going to be okay. There's really not much difference beyond the food. And you just look at people and just go, are you for real? How have you found the politics to be different? Or is it in fact a bridging language for people to understand?
A bridging language. I love that. Look, there must be differences. I haven't yet, though, worked in a way or at a level where I've seen massive differences. You know, the level that I work at across the world, whether it's executives at London Business School or doctors, highly specialized doctors who are coming into Stanford for a leadership program, or graduates in South Africa, or really whatever, because I have pretty much lectured all over the world. The points that I make around political will and political skill resonate irrespective of the audience, irrespective of the nationality, the culture, the organization, the gender, the level of seniority. Absolutely, there's no question that when you get into the practice and the application of the principles, you're going to find different things. And so, for example, I can think of a group of women from the Middle East who were at London Business School who totally bought into the principles of what I was saying. But in Saudi Arabia, how they could apply those principles, the degree to which they could apply those principles, were by definition different by virtue of the culture. So, yes, the application and the limitations for sure are going to be different. But so far, 7 years in, a PhD in, a book in, I haven't yet found massive differences that negate the principles. Like I say, it's the application that differs.
If we talk about the invisible curriculum of leadership and people are trying to work out, okay, I've bought this concept, Nipun, and I understand that politics in my role is in fact the white space between the words and the paragraphs in my job description. How would you help people to start on that journey of realization that that's true?
So I think there's probably three steps. I mean, the first one is this podcast is a great start, right? I mean, to just be aware of a subject that you thought you understood and realized, hold on a second, I probably didn't understand that. I mean, this is not an insignificant change. And so I often say that there are very few paradigm shifts in the world, actually. I mean, for the most part, when it comes to learning and development, you know, we're adding more apps to the existing operating system. But the paradigms, the operating system are pretty intact. I think in my experience, certainly if I speak for myself and the people I've interacted with, the people who've reached out to me, rethinking something so fundamental, so profoundly, is changing the operating system. Hold on a second. There are myths here, and those myths are wrong. This myth that I can be a good person or I can play politics. Oh, I can be both. This myth that this stuff doesn't make a difference in my career. Oh, it does. Best I roll up my sleeves or understand the consequences. This myth that I can escape this stuff, you can never escape it. You can't. It's just the degree of politicization that you can change. The myth that this stuff disappears in a virtual environment, but because of course I don't have to deal with office politics if I'm not in the office. Wrong. And the myth that, you know, this is a trait that I'm either born with or I'm not. No, it's a skill. And if it matters enough to you, you can learn the skill. So just that awareness that the single story I have around something that's so endemic, so prevalent, so inescapable, the single story is wrong. I can make it much richer, much more expansive, much more open to possibility. I think that's the first step, the awareness. The second step is, okay, well, now that I know what I didn't know, now that I'm consciously incompetent, well, how do I stack up? And, you know, there's tons of stuff that I give out freely, deliberately on my website. Assessments, scorecards. Okay, so where do I stack up? How politically intelligent or stupid am I? How politicized is my workplace? Who are the stakeholders I've got in my environment? I mean, just start looking at this stuff, start assessing yourself. And then the third thing is, okay, well, now I know what I didn't know. Now I know what I need to know because I can see where my opportunities and my gaps are. Well, that's the what and the so what. Now it's about the now what. You know, what do I do about this? Where do I take it? And that's about your political strategy. And frankly, as with all strategies, company strategies, life strategies, career strategies, you know, this will evolve as the contexts change, as your goals change. So your political strategy will evolve as well. And so your skills will develop as you put these into practice. So I would really say those are the three steps. Awareness, this podcast is giving you that already. Assessment, and then action.
I do love that. I mean, the way that I've often translated this, because I often felt in my various stages in career coming out of the military and then into the spin cycle that was financial services to sort of needed a job, got a job, did reasonably well, didn't understand the thing that politics was, but could see it in plain sight, understood there were games being played. Once I think I understood what the game was, I could navigate through that. And then company building for the last 25 years and spending a lot of time with companies on the other side, trying to work out an option for us to expand or secure supply chains or whatever the case was. I translated that politics in my mind to be, I need to try and make these other people successful. Not necessarily, and not by any means on a token basis. I need to learn in a humane, authentic way what is going to make them successful and what to what extent can I help them become successful. And I built this habit around, and it didn't matter if it was a CEO in the US or in China who was trying to sell me something, which we knew the commerce was happening. It was just that we wanted to go a little bit deeper because we knew that if things went wrong, and this was the unspoken rule, if things went wrong, there was almost a back channel conversation that could be had that was in good faith because we had an existing relationship, because we truly understood what we were trying to get out of this. And I set my career on that path. So everything that's gone through from that point, which are, you know, early 2000s, has been built off the back of that. So when people are trying to think about politics in their own context, it might be useful for them to think about, well, maybe you just don't know enough about what's driving the other people, because once you understand what they're actually trying to achieve, which takes time to understand, by the way, then maybe there's a different way that you can engage with them that doesn't feel, in inverted commas, political. It feels like it's a genuine attempt to try and make them successful, which inevitably blows back positively in most cases to the other person.
I love it. Violently agree.
Interesting. Let's turn our attention to your work today. So I've seen the work you do in AIDS, in the way that you've really thought carefully about how you apply everything you've learned in your career and the influence you have to really important humanitarian concerns. Every country has the burden of something that is socially difficult to think about and talk about and engage. It looks from the outside that you've really, pardon the pun, you know, grabbed the bull by the horns and engaged wholly and soulfully in those kind of efforts. Can we dive into that a little bit and what brought you to that point?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. Look, it was also an opportunity that was given to me And I suppose, I mean, what you're referring to for people who don't know much about my background is I headed up a large NGO in the early 2000s when HIV/AIDS was completely rampant in sub-Saharan Africa. And we had approximately 1 million orphaned and vulnerable children in South Africa. And, you know, so orphaned is self-explanatory, vulnerable, probably also self-explanatory. But, I mean, we even had an acronym for child-headed households. So, I mean, you know, Phil, here we're talking about 13 or 14-year-olds, 15-year-olds raising their siblings because the adults had died. Grandmothers, great-grandmothers raising grandchildren, having done everything right, you know, having put their kids through school, through university, and then HIV/AIDS just ran rampant. And so I think there are things in my life, in my career, where I couldn't not do them. And choosing to live in South Africa, and as I say in my LinkedIn profile, I'm South African by birth. I mean, you're in Australia. You know how many South Africans have immigrated to Australia. I'm South African by birth, and I'm African by choice. I mean, I choose to be in this country, and it's a incredibly complex country and, you know, all manner of extremes in South Africa. And I'm global in the work that I do, and I love that combination. But by choosing to be African and South African and choosing to stay here, well, like many people in a country that has the highest Gini coefficient, so highest income inequality in the world, I mean, I could choose to sit in my gated community and have my frame of reference be anything other than the parallel universes of this country. Or I could be deeply invested in this country and all its complexity. And at that time, that was an inescapable complexity. I mean, it was insane. In fact, I was actually talking to my mom just the other day, remembering how I had gone out to do some work in a deep rural area of South Africa. And I mean, it was like a parallel century, a parallel universe. Deep, deep, deep rural area, no running water, no electricity. The teachers were on strike and they were stopping the kids coming to the project that we had to get food. And it took me 7 hours to drive back from that area to Johannesburg. And by the time I reached my middle class, upper middle class suburb in Johannesburg and all the private schools and all the parents picking up their kids playing rugby and hockey, I mean, no running water, no electricity, teachers on strike and kids not able to eat. I mean, it was like on a completely different planet. But it was only 7 hours drive from where I live. And frankly, I didn't even have to drive 7 hours. I can drive half an hour to a deeply impoverished area. And so I think we all have coping mechanisms. And working in the NGO sector, you have to choose how much you take on. I got very close to burnout. But what I also choose is not to disengage and live my life with blinkers and not see what's around me. So I'll volunteer as a police reservist. I'll get involved in all manner of things. And that was one of the things that I couldn't not do. And then I got to the point where I couldn't do it anymore. It was just too much.
Thank you for sharing that. If there's one thing that I've learned in this last half hour, and I feel as though I could speak to you for days and days and days on all of these topics, is that there is this capacity you have to hold in paradox all of these different potentially conflicting ideals. And it's a very unique skill set to have. You mentioned earlier that this idea of politics, you know, you could be this or you could do that. And the reality is that holding both intention is part of the human condition. It is a very difficult skill to get to. And I think we arrive at it later in life because early in life we've been thrown decisions which by virtue of the idea you're made to make a choice one way or the other, and you're not really taught to hold both things together. And this example that you've just mentioned here is another one of those. I think every country has a very difficult set of truths that it grapples with, and it's very easy for people like you and I to sit in a podcast studio and have this conversation and say that these are the things, but I think they're very, very real. And I feel in the last sort of 2 or 3 years, it's become more pronounced. And I fear for our children that they're going to be facing this in a more severe way over the next 10, 15, 20 years as well.
I completely hear what you're coming, where you're coming from. And first of all, thank you for that compliment. It's a lovely compliment, not one I've been given before, but I am deeply touched by it. And yes, I mean, I think that this is the challenge for all of us, but I think this challenge is amplified today in the face of the scale and speed of the complexity and that we're all dealing with. And I mean, I won't trot out the cliches around change because they're so cliched. But yeah, I mean, I think if we only think about it from a political point of view and from an identity point of view in countries around the world, I read something the other day and I thought, yep, that's exactly right. That populism is the denial of complexity. And I thought, isn't that the truth? And I mean, we're seeing the rise of populism all over the world. Yeah. And the denial of complexity allows for the safety, the false safety, the sanctuary of simple stories, of us and them, of really falling into the trap that Oliver Wendell Holmes, that American jurist, spoke about, where he said, I wouldn't give a fig for simplicity this side of complexity, but I'd give my life for simplicity that side of complexity. Mm. I think most of the world, and sometimes me too, I'm not immune to it, we sit on this side of complexity. We grasp at the single stories. We grasp at a sense of rightness. We grasp at a sense of, like I say, the us and themness. But to sit in that tumble dryer, that washing machine of complexity, and all that it means and all that it requires of us, I mean, is painful. It's difficult. It's not something any of us rush towards. We rush towards the single and the easy. Mm. But to get on the other side of that, saying, okay, hold on. I have really thought this through. I have wrestled with it. And this is what I know to be true now and what I sit with in my own understanding of myself and the world. That's not an easy journey. But, you know, it's an important one because, frankly, for every complex problem, there's an answer that is simple, that is easy, and that is wrong. And that is not my quote. That's W.L. Mencken's quote, and he's right.
When I think about two companies, two institutions, two people trying to work out how to do things better together, and I have a very deep-seated belief that we are better together. And that there is a bridge to be built in William Urey's terms. I would love to get your take on how you would think of all of this life experience in the context of forging partnerships to achieve something that two entities, I'll just call them entities because it could be in any construct,
yes,
could achieve not alone. So that we're almost forced as a human civilization to find ways to partner to make things work, whether it be survival or whether it be to build breakthrough technologies. We've talked a lot today about how to balance paradox, how to think deeply about the other person's incentives, how to help navigate through complexity. When you think of partnerships, and it could be in your experience or things you've observed, what are some of the hallmarks that make great partnerships work in your experience?
So I loved what you said around paradox. And I suppose there's a paradox here, or there's an opportunity here as well. And it's balancing the what matters to you and what matters to the other person. So let me elaborate on that. I had a friend a few years ago, and she doesn't mind me sharing this because, of course, I don't share her details, and it's an important story. She had a complete nervous breakdown. It was devastating as someone who loves her deeply to watch. And she pieced the pieces of herself back together again with a lot of love and help from a lot of people. But what I was deeply moved by was she went to, of all things, an occupational therapist, along with a psychiatrist and psychologist. And I'm thinking, an occupational therapist, but you know, you haven't lost the use of your hands. You're an academic. But the occupational therapist sat her down at the beginning of their very first session and didn't ask what I would have thought to be a completely reasonable and obvious question. He didn't ask what matters to you. I mean, sorry, he didn't ask what's the matter with you. Let's edit that out. He didn't ask what's the matter with you. He asked, what matters to you? And I thought, how fascinating. What matters to you? And what she started to realize through these sessions was that everything that mattered to her was being so systematically ignored, dismantled, trampled on at work, that frankly, a nervous breakdown was a very reasonable protective mechanism and very reasonable response. And so I think it's a paradox of being very clear what matters to you, and then equally being incredibly curious and intentional about what matters to the other person. And I have a slide that I love where it's a cartoon, well, it's a diagram. Me, and I'm a planet, is in the diagram, and then the world, you know, so the world is orbiting around me. I mean, we all do that. We are the center of our own universes.
Yep.
And that matters. What matters to you matters, and you need to know it, and you need to hold on to it, because otherwise horrendous things can happen. But what matters to the other person needs to matter just as much. And that Venn diagram possibility and overlap, well, that's where magic can happen and does happen. And it's a place of both curiosity and courage, you know. Courage to be convinced that who you are and what you are going to stick to is important, but curiosity around what matters to the other person. I think that both end.
Amen. I mean, the idea of, and our daughters at the dinner table 2 nights ago, we were talking about this idea of curiosity. And the principal of the school, or the former principal of the school, had shared I think she thought it was a quib at the time, but it was a question that she often asked the girls just walking through the playground or when she bumped into them at some point. And it was, what made you curious today?
Oh, and, lovely.
You know, we're in this circumstance in the season of life where for some reason the parents who are listening to this will probably relate that at the end of the day, when you are at your most fatigued, this is the point at which children would like to have a long conversation about their day. And it's, and you know, talking about paradoxes, you know, it's a super important time that will pass. There will come a time where you will not have these conversations anymore. And you are dog tired at the end of the day. And so what I ended up creating as a consequence of that great question that was offered to us in the spirit of an educator offering, you know, guidance to us, was that question is one of my favorite draw cards. And it's interesting to see how that plays out in their lives, because it does encourage them to become more observatory and more curious as a consequence. And as a result, gives them a lens to look through the complexity of, you know, as we call them for younger kids, you know, friendship fires, and the ability to sort of understand, take a step back and go, why is this happening in the way that it's happening? As opposed to internalizing very quickly, which can also happen to all of us, the thing that has gone wrong. And the parallels between that and business, I think, tend to carry through with us all the time. I hope that leaders become more curious as they get older. I fear, in some cases, however, just the blunt force trauma of every day dulls the sense to be able to get more curiosity out of every day.
I would agree. It does become a survival mechanism. I mean, I remember having a conversation with somebody years ago when I was talking about the culture change that, in this case, the governor was trying to do in the Reserve Bank. And this chap had been there at the Reserve Bank at one of the branches for years, in fact, his entire career. And he looked at me and he said, please, you know, I've seen governors come and go. I've seen initiatives come and go. I've seen governments come and go in this country. They all want to change things and I'm still here. They've gone and things are still the same. He said, so I'm actually just a cynic. And, you know, Phil, I don't know where this response came from, because I'd never consciously thought this or thought about this until this man said this to me. But as he said this to me, I looked at him and I said, you know, in my experience, cynics are just disillusioned idealists. And I'm telling you, I don't know who was more surprised, him or me, when the tears sprang to his eyes. And I thought, wow, I've struck a nerve there, and not intentionally. So, yeah, I mean, I think we all find ways to cope, but when that coping becomes an armor and becomes a cynicism, well, then we've lost an opportunity. And, yeah, I love the advice from the principal, but if I can give you any advice, I don't have my own kids, but a friend of mine whose kids finished high school a few years ago, and she was a single mom for a number of years, and she just thought, I cannot do this anymore, you know, a few days, more than once, actually. She thought, it's time to send them off to boarding school, because she had twin girls. Mm-hmm. And the last day of high school, when she was making her last lunchbox, she suddenly realized the truth of the fact that, sure, you know, the days are short. The days are long, but the years are short.
Yes.
And she thought, yeah, those days have been excruciatingly long sometimes, but the years are short. It's now over.
That's it. In our last sort of part of this conversation, I would love to explore the way in which people who are engaging in partnerships in business could reframe their idea of politics. And we've already touched on a number of ways that you can do it through the awareness step and then trying to find ways to have that curiosity. The reason I ask is because there are more than 90% of global commerce happens through partnership. And people will often look at that number and be quite surprised about that. But when you look at the way that goods are shipped from one country to the next, the way that we buy things any other day, there is an intricate network of partnerships that are going on. And in the world where we're seeing it evolve to now, where there is more knowledge workers, where there is a different way of manufacturing, where there is going to be more AI brought into this, I'm deeply curious about how people should be reframing politics in a way to help them achieve the goals they need to achieve at an individual, maybe a company level, but how we bridge a lot of this gap. Because going back to being better together, I fear that if we don't get better at this, then the consequences can be quite profound. But at the same time, it's not that difficult, at least in my view, to become better at politics, whichever way you want to position that in your own mind. How do we help people move to a place where they don't sell their soul, but they are finding a way to navigate and feel more comfortable that if I get a better grasp of this politics thing, then maybe what I can achieve is something much grander than I possibly ever thought about before?
Yeah. So, I mean, I love that question because underpinning that question is a question of risk, right? And I remember at the central bank having a speaker come in for a lunchtime session, and I needed to host him as the head of the department, and he had a PhD on risk and he was going to talk about it for an hour. And I thought, I'm not sure they'd pay me enough to host somebody to talk about risk for an hour. But okay, you know, let me put on my screensaver expression and be the most gracious host that I can. And of course, it was a fascinating conversation because it was so unexpected. And what he spoke about was, in fact, and this is a PhD in risk, who headed up the South African Institute of Risk Management or something equally arcane and impressive. And he said, actually, there's two definitions of risk. Of course, there's the risk that we all are aware of in terms of the definition. Something will go wrong. So mitigate, prevent, ameliorate, control, make sure it doesn't happen. So the risk that bad things will happen, yes. But there's an equal and opposite category of risk, which I don't know about you, Phil, but I was never exposed to, never measured on, never asked about as a manager, as a leader, as an employee. And it's the risk that good things will not happen. The risk that good things will not happen, the counterfactual, what if, what might have. And so I think when it comes to politics and political intelligence and political capital, what I'm talking about is the value that accrues or does not when you spend your time and energy and effort in investing in four things: your strategic relationships, your partnerships, but also your formal authority, your influence, which of course is influence over other people, which is partnerships in another form, and then your reputation, which again speaks to partnerships, because basically, I mean, what is a reputation other than trust at scale?
That's it.
And so when you build your relationships, your influence, your formal authority, and your reputation, I mean, all manner of things can happen in terms of possibilities, in terms of opportunities. And then, of course, when you don't, all manner of things will not happen. And rather than this being a virtuous cycle, it becomes a vicious cycle. And the less you are able to achieve for yourself and for others and for people who are counting on you, or the more you are able to achieve. And so, you know, this is what I'm talking about when I'm talking about the political. I'm talking about the informal. I'm talking about the unofficial. And I'm talking about these four things. So often what I suggest to people is, well, you know, if the framing of politics, understandably, is so inevitably, impossibly only negative, well, then don't call it politics. Call it whatever you want. Call it, you know what? I'm going out today to be effective in the informal space. I'm going out there to deliver to my stakeholders. I'm going out there to build my informal, unofficial influence. I mean, because there are very few people who wake up in the morning, I'm going to work today or build partnerships and play politics, you know, rubbing their hand in glee. No, I mean, very few people say that ever. So, okay, so if you can't say that, no matter the definition, don't say it. Frame it in any way that you want. Frame it in a way that does give you a sense of possibility and agency. And then go from that sense of agency and possibility with whatever language and framing allows you to do that, to both realize, well, to make sure that the bad things don't happen and to make sure that the good things can happen for you and for everyone else.
I love that. That is for every person who is worried about risk, please take note of that. Because you're right, the possibility for the upside often catches people by surprise. Anyone who is even a micrometer removed from the circumstance will go, well, yeah, that's the side of the coin you weren't looking at. Please look at that side of the coin more often.
Yes, absolutely. And I mean, I was the chair of the board of an NGO for 6 years. And for the first few years, I was just concerned about the risk that bad things will happen. We're stewarding resources, we're stewarding all manner of things. And maybe because my term was coming to an end and the term limits in terms of the constitution meant that I only had 2 years left. And I suddenly thought, no, hold on a second. I need to start thinking about the risk of good things not happening here if we are not slightly more adventurous with the resources at our disposal. And it profoundly shifted how I approached things.
That's extraordinary. Niven, I would like to ask now that we have a second conversation, because I think there is... I have a ton of ideas that I would love to throw around with you in the context of how we can weave your focus on politics into some of the work that we do in relation to helping people frame how to identify and embrace an ideal partnership. That's another conversation. So I'd love to invite you to do that now. Feel free to have a think about that. In the meantime, though, I would love to ask you one question before we get to our rapid fire, which is, what do you think leaders in the world right now are missing about the power and the potential of partnership and working together?
That we really don't have a choice. We really don't have a choice. I think in a world of polycrises, of insane and incomprehensible complexity. You know, I'm the program director for the Archbishop Tutu Leadership Fellowship. I was a fellow myself in 2007, and I now run the program, which happens once a year with exceptional leaders from across Africa. And, you know, Archbishop Tutu said something said lots of interesting and powerful and profound and memorable things. But the one thing that I love, that's one of his lesser known quotes, is he said, if we want peace, we don't talk to our friends, we talk to our enemies. And I think it's such an obvious thing to say, but in a world of such polarization, where it's just inconceivable that someone who disagrees with me may have something worth hearing, that someone who disagrees with me may be right about one or two things. We have so entrenched our camps and so stuck to them and so settled into a place of incredibly dangerous identity politics. Tell me who you vote for and I can tell you everything about you. No, that may just be who I vote for, but there are nuances. There are complexities and I don't think we see them. We just are completely immune to them. And so we are all in this together. And it's like that cartoon of two people sitting in a boat, and the one side has got a hole in it. And the person on the other side is saying, well, I'm really glad my side of the boat doesn't have a hole in it. I mean, it's hilarious in a cartoon, but I mean, this is the global reality that we're all living in. And we don't see how insane this is, how ludicrous this is, but, you know, more importantly, how tragic this is, because we're all in this together.
I have a value that I've placed across all of my companies. And it's probably when you think of value statements that live on walls and live in PowerPoint documents and, you know, the way that you hopefully assess someone's contribution, the one that I've always come back to, as if someone said, you know, what is the one, the only one that you would hold on to, it's this. It's about being deeply afraid about missing a very important perspective. And the only way that that can happen, for that realization to come true and for you to miss things, is for you not to have that curiosity that asks the simple question, what if? And it's very easy to sit here and say that, but when you move past the screens, when you move past the bravado and you get one-on-one in a conversation with the other person or their team or whatever else, and you ask that simple question, it is remarkable how quickly you get to the nub of the issue. And how quickly both sides can say, look, what we really need is this. And the number of times that becomes the obvious, it is so obvious, you will often see people on the other side of the table look at each other and go, well, okay, sure, we can probably do that. And so I guess the topping out of this episode, which you've really helped me understand and clarify, is just be the person who goes and asks that question. Be the person who's able to understand the interests. And if you need to reframe it as a game, you know, if everyone can say, what's the game we're playing here? And not to over-trivialize that, find a way to become an expert in what makes the other person tick, not for nefarious intent, but to try and make them successful. Because there is often such goodness that comes from that.
Yeah, and I think, you know, one of the things I most believe, and this is not my quote, it's somebody else's, but the shortest distance between two people is a story. And understanding somebody else's story of themselves, of the world, the stories that have got them to this point. I mean, we've shared some stories in this podcast. I have never failed to be moved by the power of stories. The stories we have, about ourselves, about the world, about each other. That's also a very African way of looking at the world. Stories.
Let me ask you five rapid fire questions. There are no wrong answers, but I do have to caveat one of them because I get it wrong. And it's the second one. We'll get to that in a second. So are you ready to go? Shall we dive into this?
Yes.
All right, let's do it. Complete this sentence. Partnership is?
Possibility.
What content are you loving at the moment? And it can be anything.
Stuff that makes me cry because it's so beautiful. Because I've realized the older I get and the more I see the sadness and the ugliness of the world, actually it's the beauty of the world that makes me cry. So content that makes me cry because it's just beautiful.
You know, I never cried as much as I do in movies since we had our girls, and I have to be very careful what movies I go to now. Something has happened. I don't know what's happening, but it's. I find that when I'm sitting there, the girls will look at me and just go, "Are you welling up?" I said yes, but Dad, it's Iron Man. I know.
Yeah. Well, like I said, I read something once that said, the moment you have kids, you walk with your heart outside of you for the rest of your life. So
that is true. That is 100% true. Yeah. Question three, what's the worst piece of advice you've received and why?
The worst piece of advice the worst thing I did, and it's partly the advice as well, is I asked a manager that I really love and respected and still do, you play the politics with Exco so I can get on with things. And this person who I still deeply respect said yes. He should have said no. He should have said, no, we will build relationships with Exco. Don't leave me to do it, because then when something happens to me, as something did, you're totally exposed. So I don't know that that was advice, but it was one of the biggest mistakes that I made.
Yeah, I get that. Question four, when you see potential for a new partnership, what's the first thing you do to turn that potential into action?
Let's get started. You know, Gallup Strengths Finder, one of my top strengths is an activator. So mm-hmm. whatever it means, let's just get going.
Awesome. And the final question, what's one thing you're deeply grateful for right now?
My gratitude, that I am grateful, that there are very few things. I you know, we all have a list of I've got to. I mean, it just never ends. And years ago on a run, I had the litany of I've got to going through my head. And suddenly I thought of a friend of mine who was very sick in hospital. And I don't know where this came from. It's a classic coaching thing, but at that point I'd never been coached. I suddenly just, hold on, I get to run up this hill. I get to go home. I get to do this while this friend of mine is very ill. And Phil, I can think of only one thing since then that I haven't been able to reframe from a got to a get to. Even when my dad was dying, I could honestly, without toxic positivity, because that's nauseating, but I could sit with my dad and I could honestly really, really understand and believe and acknowledge. I get to say goodbye to my father. You know, not everyone does. People get killed in car accidents. People are estranged and then they die. I get to say goodbye to my father.
Mm. We get to have this conversation.
No, oh, well, isn't that nice?
Which I'm very, very, very grateful for. It's. Oh. I can already see and feel the feeling that people are going to have listening to this. And I've got two people in particular who I know are going to absolutely adore this conversation. Oh. Niven, where can we point people to learn more about your work, to get your fabulous book? We'll link to all of these in the show notes, but where are we sending people?
My website, nivinpostma.com, and I'm very active on LinkedIn. I love the sound of my own opinions. And as my sister said to me, God bless younger sisters. And I love to share them on LinkedIn. And I engage with all the comments there. So those are the two best places.
Fantastic. Well, we will see you there. And I look forward to the next time we get to talk.
Lovely. Me too, Phil.
Before you go, I have a quick question for you. Do you worry that you're wasting time, money, and credibility with the wrong partnerships? It's exhausting to pretend everything's fine while secretly worrying that you've made the wrong call. You see others thriving with the right connections and you're stuck wondering if you're missing out on opportunities that could really elevate your business. Well, the good news is that ends today, because you can download my free partner calculator that instantly assesses if a partner is an ideal fit for your business. It'll give you the clarity and the confidence and the edge you've been looking for to secure high-value partnerships that not only finally unlock business growth, but also help you reclaim your time. The link is in the show notes. And I'm really glad you're here. I'm Coach Phil Hayes Sinclair. I'll see you in the next episode.